Viking believes that a journey on the rivers of the world can be an experience designed for the thinking person. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Learn how to plan, invest, and live smarter with the Raymond James For What It's Worth podcast. Featuring insights from leading professionals, you'll get the latest in wealth management, market commentary, and engaging research. Listen today at raymondjames.com/podcast.
I'm Jace Lacob, and you're listening to Masterpiece Studio. In his time staying with his sister Demelza and his brother-in-law Ross Poldark, Drake Karn has faced death not once, but two separate times, both on trumped-up charges devised mainly to spite Ross.
The court in its mercy grants reprieve to Samuel Karn and Drake Karn.
Drake got off, of course, first thanks to Morwenna, his now wife, and later thanks to a passionate public speech from Ross. But his marriage to Morwenna remained chaste after her painful and violent previous marriage to the Reverend Ozzie Whitworth.
When we married, I thought, hoped, that I could be a proper wife to you.
You are a proper wife.
Waking, yes, yet abed. I cannot.
But as haphazard and foolish as Drake's kidnapping plans to secure his wife's happiness may have been, they were successful, lending Morwenna the closure to fully embrace her marriage to her one true love.
Today I did grieve and let him go. Tonight my heart is sore, but it is free to love you.
Near-death experiences weren't explicitly in the cards when actor Harry Richardson signed up for his role as Drake Karn, but he's enjoyed the ride and is anticipating the conclusions still to come in just a few episodes. And this week we are joined by Poldark star Harry Richardson. Welcome.
Hey man, thanks for having me.
Drake Karn is introduced to Poldark in season 3. The script reads, "A young man, 19, boyish, handsome, bright-eyed, buoyant, walks purposefully along the cliff-top path. He is heading for Nampara. Something about him reminds us of Demelza, the way he looks about him, appreciating the day, the landscape, nature in all its beauty, and the way he hums to himself a familiar song."
Now this old man went out to roam, twee, tweedle go twee.
What did you first make of the character of Drake Karn?
I was really taken by how wide-eyed and innocent and honest and well-meaning he was. He was a very pure of heart character that was quite a little scary to approach straight away because, you know, everyone wants to play these kind of dark and twisted ones. It's hard to come in with a big open heart and open eyes, but I was excited to get to know him.
Drake quickly falls in love with Geoffrey Charles's relation, Morwenna Chenoweth. What does he see in Morwenna and what possibilities does she offer him initially?
Well, I think it's that inexplicable love at first sight. I think he falls head over heels. I remember the first scenes being, I think, down on the coastline when we cross paths, and he's just completely taken aback by her beauty and her grace, and she's from a different class, so I think it instantly poses a bit of a problem for him, but he doesn't really see that. He just knows that he's already in love with her and has to figure that out.
We am strangers ourselves. Do we bide in these parts or just be passing through?
She's staying. Are you not Morwenna?
Morwenna? 'Tis a Lilton, musical name. I'm Drake. 'Tis a pleasure to meet ye.
And you, sir?
I hope we may meet again.
That sense of sort of class gulf between them, is that down to his own sort of naivete or inability to kind of see the distinctions in their class?
I think his pure innocence. I think the two of them were really indicative of the fact that class distinctions shouldn't be a thing, and that love overcomes all, you know, because in a world that was so segregated and people were in different groups and different, you know, areas of society, these two didn't even see that. They just knew that they wanted to be with each other.
So many of your scenes on Poldark were with Elise Chappell, who plays Morwenna. What was it like working with Elise for the past three seasons, and what did she bring to your scenes together?
I mean, it wouldn't have been the same without her. I think she made the entire experience for me. She was so open and creative and just really loving, and I think from the get-go we both had a lot of love for the characters, so all we wanted to do was do them justice and try to help each other to find this little romance for us to create. But we were constantly just kept each other laughing and easy and comfortable. And we were both a little shocked when we started, because neither of us had done something of this size or a long format show. And so we were both really nervous. I think we calmed each other down, I think.
Drake and Morwenna have a star-crossed quality to them. They fall in love. She has to marry an abusive vicar to save his life, as one does. And then they finally get together, but they can't consummate their love. Does their love embody a sort of romance that feels doomed but actually contains a great deal of hope?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I could have put that better. They are very hopeful characters, and they do have a lot of problems thrown their way. I mean, Drake's always almost getting killed, and she's getting married off to, you know, quite a devil-like man. And yet they stay hopeful and in love. I think they're really indicative of how powerful love can be.
One of my favorite Morwenna and Drake scenes is from season 3 at Trenwith, when they finally acknowledge their love for each other and kiss by the pond.
Oh, Drake, why do you suppose this has anything to do with the heart? That is not how the world works. But we are in the world, and we must keep to its rules.
Must we?
Yes. And if you don't know that by now...
I don't know anything, Morwenna, except for what you tell me. So look me in the eyes and tell me you don't love me.
What do you recall about filming that particular scene?
I just seem to remember an argument for some reason with the director was running tight on time, and we were really nervous and kind of everyone was trying to get it right and do it justice, and it really added to the tension of the scene and the frisson and the energy, I think, because we were all just really nervous and running around in those woods. Yeah, I remember that well.
It's interesting you use the word tension. I think so many of Drake and Morwenna's scenes together teeter between being really chaste and really sexy at the same time. There is that sort of inherent frisson. There's that beautiful one in the dunes where Morwenna rests her head on Drake's back as she examines his bruise. I mean, was it difficult to capture that balance in those scenes together?
I mean, it had all been written so beautifully that I think it was just a matter of, like, trying to do justice to what was on the page. Debbie's an incredible writer, and a lot of it was there. We just had to get out of our own way and try to do it justice. That was definitely something that we talked a lot about, was that, like, push-pull between feeling comfortable and having to hold back, and what's right and what's wrong and the obstacles in the way. And I think that makes for quite a sexy energy.
My absolute favorite scene with you and Elise is the OG Holywell scene where Drake and Morwenna take Jeffrey
OG.
Charles down into the cave. It is the OG Holywell scene.
'Tis a wishing well too, they say. What you do is dip your right hand in the water, saying Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and then your wish is granted.
That's sacrilege.
'Tisn't though. Begging your pardon, but this be a holy place as much as any church.
I remember Elise saying that you actually shot this in a Cornish cliff, and that it was, quote, magical.
Yeah.
Did you feel that same sense of magic at the time when you shot that?
Oh, 100%. I'd never been on a location like that. There's this incredible split and cave in Holywell Bay that the director was teasing us, being like, I found the most magical place on earth to do this scene. And we were like, oh, yeah, sure, whatever. It's going to be this little, you know, cave. And we walked in to just, like, it really was just like dripping down perfectly from the roof, and like it was all glistening in this beautiful cave, and the crash of waves was like muted as you walked around the corner of it. It was so beautiful. And we were just in between setups running around barefoot on the beach and then come in and do this beautiful little love scene. It was so much fun.
Out of all the characters, even more so than Ross, I think, Drake might be the one who has had his neck on the chopping block the most. He seems to constantly find himself under threat of execution. What is it about Drake that makes him such a target for trouble?
I think just because he's so puppy dog-like and he means best, you know? People often get trodden on with a big open heart, and it's hard to stay open because people want to, you know, trample it, I suppose. He's so wide-eyed that I think he just wound up in a bunch of very dangerous situations. But I think also some of them were on him, you know? Like, he was definitely defiantly chasing after love that he was meant to be denied. And so part of it's a rebellion in him.
The Karn siblings have been at the center of Poldark for the last three seasons. How would you describe Drake's steadfast relationship with Demelza and Sam?
They have a very interesting relationship because they all challenge each other, but they have a lot of love and unity. I think they're all trying to find their own way in the world and their own ideals, and they sometimes conflict with each other, which is just like my family, I suppose. But, you know, and everybody's siblings, but they have like this intense connection as siblings that keeps them together, and a lot of love there.
Drake jilted poor Rosina at the altar in season four, breaking her heart when he learned that Morwenna had been widowed and he might be able to be with her. What did you make of Rosina and Drake's doomed match and of Drake throwing her over for Morwenna?
It was very beautifully written because it was always kind of awkward and two young people trying to make sense of it and trying to push something to be when it wasn't, which I think is something that happens very often. But yeah, I loved that relationship and Drake and Rosina's scenes. I thought it was really, really interesting, quite like both quite heartbroken in the fact that it wasn't going to work and there was always a feeling there. So then when it did come that Morwenna was free of Ozzy, it was like, let's be honest about this, I suppose.
Drake is living a sort of half-life with Morwenna. They're married, but their marriage is entirely sexless. Does his love for her transcend what Drake calls carnal love, or is Drake merely willing to wait for her, no matter how long it might take?
Oh, I definitely believe that it transcends it. I really believed Drake's scenes, like on the page where he's trying to profess his love to her and that no matter what it looks like, he just wants to be near her to experience the world. I thought it was a really, really beautiful sentiment. And I think the kid was like very, very in love with her, that even if he couldn't touch her or kiss her, he would be so happy for the rest of his life.
He does try to kiss Morwenna at Trenwith, and she physically recoils from him.
How peaceful it is. Don't touch me.
Forgive me. Forgive me. Will I light us a fire?
How much does this moment hurt him?
I think it hurts him a lot more that he's hurt her. I don't think there was an aspect of him feeling let down or something was missing. I think, I don't think you can blame him that he just tried to kiss her in a moment of adoration. But I don't think he's left wanting or feeling like something's broken. I think he just feels so much for her being in pain, which is quite beautiful.
And there's genuine anguish in Drake's voice as he tells Sam that the only hopes he has for a child is a fairy child.
Deed Morwenna by the key. Is there news?
Oh, what manner of news?
She looks so delicate and pale, I thought maybe there was...
What?
A child coming.
Not unless it's a fairy child.
She to keep her distance still.
She's yet so broken. It may never mend.
Given Drake's roughshod childhood, what does having a child of his own represent, and why does its impossibility make him ache so?
Yeah, I suppose maybe part of him always still imagined having a family with Morwenna and was very passionate about it. But I think that those lines that she may never mend, you know, I don't think that's that's woe is me for his own state and his own desires, but like really depressed and distressed about the fact that she's in so much pain. I think them having a family in his mind might mean that she's healed and that he can help her move on to give her what she would want if she didn't have so much trauma.
We do see that. I mean, they actually almost kiss on the cliff and they hold hands. She allows him to take her hand. Mm. And then later she actually does take his hands in hers. And to me, those are signs that there is inherent hope for the two of them, that they can overcome the damage and abuse in her life, that she can let go and move on.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully put.
Before this next question, a brief word from our sponsors.
Ocean voyages, expeditions, river journeys. Viking is dedicated to bringing travelers closer to the destination, offering a small ship experience and a shore excursion in every port. Learn more at viking.com.
Coming up next on Masterpiece on PBS, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office continues Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, followed by the finale of Alice and Jack at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. Drake has watched from afar as Morwenna has spied on and then gradually reintroduced herself to her son, John Conan. In this week's episode, Drake goes so far as to kidnap John Conan from Lady Whitworth. What did Drake hope to achieve with this incredibly risky scheme?
I think he thought that that was the thing that was missing in his innocent way, was just like, well, I'll just fix it then. I'll just make sure that she can have him around, you know, if she's missing her child, like simple just to go collect him and bring him home to Morwenna. But obviously that's not how it would go down in reality, and he'd probably lose his head for it.
But it's sort of a Labrador with a tennis ball.
Exactly, you know, just wants
he
to...
just drops wants to it at her time. Feet.
Just wants to please her.
I mean, it takes Demelza telling Drake that he could put himself and Morwenna in serious peril by running away with John Conan. He's tempted, however, even if it means leaving his entire family behind.
Morwenna had no choice but to let him go, but she has no rights to him that Lady Whitworth could not contest in court.
So we'll take him without her consent.
And live where? Not in Seoul. You'd have to leave all of us behind, your forge, your home, and start anew somewhere she could never find you.
What makes Drake change his mind and return the child to Lady Whitworth?
The risk for Morwenna. The risk that, like, that they'd lose the little stability that they had and be run out of town and have to go with, you know, not a penny or just to fend for themselves and run from the law, I suppose. I think putting her at risk and also the child at risk is what makes him take it back. He doesn't
mind
risking his own life.
I mean, and to me, that's sort of his main focus is this sort of need to keep Morwenna safe, to keep her happy, to try and help her.
Yeah.
And it makes, to me, in my mind anyway, Drake an even more noble character, that it is always putting Morwenna's needs before his own.
Yeah, to his detriment. He's very, very noble.
I mean, he's had his forge burned, you know, 8,000 times over the end of this show. He's almost been hanged. I mean, but he's noble at the end.
Yeah. You can't bring him down.
Drake stands up to Lady Whitworth not once but twice, even at the risk of bodily harm from her awful servants.
Your ladyship, I beg of thee, hear me out. 'Twas mine idea alone that John Conan should leave thee. And when I tell Morwenna she was furious, she've come now to make amends, to put an end to it once and for all. Nay, please don't disturb her.
So I come now to take my leave, and I'll cherish the time we had together. But I have to go away now. And I am leaving you with the kindest, most loving grandmother. I will love you and give you the most wonderful life.
What does it signify that he's willing to go to Lady Whitworth and actually plead for Morwenna?
That he'll face anything, you know, no matter what circumstance or risk or person he has to confront, he'll do it in the hope that it might heal her a little or make her a little happier or help the world, I suppose, that he's living in.
He does confess what he's done, and Morwenna says that Drake taking John Conan was a, quote, monstrous thing, and she can't even bear to look at him. Why has he miscalculated so terribly, even though his intentions were so good?
Because he's a Labrador, you know? He's coming, like when a Labrador comes in, you know, covered in mud and gets it all over the couch, like, he didn't mean to. I guess that's the thing. You can have intentions that are good, but if you're not cautious, then you end up in trouble and risking other things. But I don't know. I don't think she should have got so mad at him in that scene. I felt bad for him. He was doing his best.
Toward the end of the episode, there's a gorgeous scene where Drake and Morwenna get ready for bed.
I said farewell to my son today.
For good?
Yes. I will never go back. I love him. Will always love him. I've tried to lock away the pain of losing him. But in doing so, I've locked away other love. Love for my husband. Love I would give my husband, but could not give whilst I would not grieve the loss of my child. Today I did grieve. And let him go. Tonight my heart is sore. But it is free to love you.
Have they finally moved closer to resolving the trauma in her past and being able to move forward together?
Well, I think that was totally a step from Morwenna. She took it into her own hands, and I guess once she said goodbye to John Conan, it healed her a little more and allowed her to open her heart to her husband. I thought that was really beautifully written.
In the broadest possible strokes, I mean, what can you tease about what's coming up for Drake for the rest of this final season?
In the broader sense, I think the two of them trying to figure out if they can make it work or create a family or what that would look like and tentatively start to explore love with each other again. I think to overcome trauma and try to figure out what the next step in their life is.
This is the final season of Poldark. What will you miss most about the production and of playing Drake Karn?
Oh, I mean, definitely Cornwall. I'll definitely have to go back. I loved that place. I fell in love with it for sure. It plays such a big part in the show, and it's such a beautiful place to go. And the culture there is so gorgeous, and the people are so lovely. Definitely the main cast, you know, the siblings and Elise. And yeah, I'm going to miss it a lot. The whole crew were incredible, and we had through-line crew as well, people who had been on it the whole way through, or at least the whole way through I was on, and they were so much a part of it, and everyone was living and breathing it the entire time and so passionate about it. I think it really was a big family creating this beautiful world, and I was so lucky to just get to slot in 2 years or 3 years in, you know, and come into this magical thing that that Eleanor and Aiden and the whole cast and crew had created for 2 years beforehand. It was just like getting on a dreamy ship.
What was that like? I mean, coming in season three to a show that was already established and becoming such a major part of the show. Was there a learning curve? Was it, you know,
I mean,
strange?
It felt like cheating from a work perspective, because I got to binge the first two seasons, you know, and see all this creative world and this, the way that they spoke, and learn more about the language that was used, and the, you know, it was so rich that I felt that all I had to do was just rock up and experience it. Whereas if you're starting a new project, everyone doesn't really know what it looks like yet, and everyone's trying to create a tone and create a world together. I think I felt completely spoiled to come on to something that had been so beautifully put together. And everyone was so welcoming and so encouraging and, you know, really, really helped out. But I was also terrified. I was terrified. I was also a big fanboy. Once I got into it, I was like, oh no, now I'm like, you know, quizzing them all about what it was like shooting in season one, and they're all just like, shut up, Eric.
Did you take anything with you from the set as a memento?
Yeah. I took the little necklace that Drake made Morwenna in his forge of the mother and child. I've got that hanging up on my mirror. And I swear I have something else. Oh, I made a bunch of things, but they weren't from the set. I made a bunch of things in my blacksmith training that I have hanging around the house. I learned how to make some pretty weird, intricate things. So I've got weird metal.
I mean, how much training did you do to become a convincing blacksmith?
I did about 9 months of like 10 hours a day. Just no, I don't. I did a few long days, which were really, really fun, and just like went wild. I tried to get more lessons, but I tried to like sneak my way into getting as many as possible. It was really fun.
True or false, you almost dropped an anvil on your foot at one point during the filming of Poldark.
True, for sure. Those things are heavy.
What went through your head when they said, that's a series wrap for Harry Richardson?
I mean, it still hasn't really sunk in that we're not going back. I think I'm still in denial. It's still on, so I'm like watching it now. Every Sunday, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll be back there in a minute. I think it was such a big part of my life that it's like, it's still going to feel that way, whether we're shooting or not.
Looking back at the past three seasons that you've played Drake, is there a particular moment, either on or off of the set, that you think of most fondly now?
I definitely think those trips to Cornwall and in between setups and stuff, hanging around with Tom and Elle and Elise and stuff, especially up on those cliffs and just giggling our asses off with cups of coffee and big cold coats sitting on the top of cliffs while we'd set up for the next scene. I think those were like some of the most magical experiences I've had.
If you had to describe the final Poldark episode in one word, what would it be?
Heartfelt.
You're Australian, but your Cornish accent as Drake is A plus worthy. Hey. How difficult was it to nail the accent?
It was hard. I'd never met anyone from Cornwall when I got the audition. So I was terrified to go in the first time. And also, like, some Cornish accents are really strong. It's, like, hard to get. Now I'm used to it, but hard to understand at first. So, but we had a beautiful accent coach at the start of season three called Magella, and she was incredible, so detailed. And Tom and I had certain sentences and tricks to get us into the accent and rules to keep, and we were really diligent with each other, and we'd like keep each other in. We stayed in accent for the first season quite a lot. We would like continuously just play and try to make each other laugh in it and just to get comfortable with it. But I think, yeah, he probably pulled me up on it more than I pulled him up on it. I think he was better than I was.
I mean, do you miss that accent now?
Yeah, man, so much. But it was also written so well. Debbie wrote the whole thing in almost phonetically. So in the script, it's like you get the sounds and the accent style and the flow of the sentences she's managed to capture in using punctuation and different spelling and stuff, which was really handy. But it's definitely a really beautiful melodic accent to do. I miss it a lot.
It's amazing to listen to, but I know what you are talking about, and having read the scripts, it's sometimes impossible to know what he's actually saying.
Totally.
Until I watch the episode and I say, that's what he's saying.
Yeah.
Because it is written out so implicitly or explicitly that it only makes sense to me.
Totally. You gotta say it.
Yeah.
You gotta say it. You gotta get it out.
So now I have to ask you to say something in it.
He can't do that. I don't know if I can still do it. I mean, I haven't thought about it in a while. I always found improving in it very difficult, but because it was always written phonetically. So, but oh, wow, I haven't done it since being on set. Whoa, that was weird.
I liked it.
I've lost it.
Harry Richardson, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a delight.
As we near the final episode of Poldark, we're also near the finale of another Masterpiece series.
Let's raise the glass.
Yeah. No, not that, Jeremy. Water.
To us all, in these sacred years, and the future.
We'll speak to the fictional Durrells family and series creator Simon Nye after the finale of The Durrells in Corfu next Sunday, November 3rd. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Nick Anderson. Alicia Baitoup is our editor. Suzanne Simpson is our executive producer. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking Cruises, Raymond James, and the Masterpiece Trust. Masterpiece Studio is officially a Webby Awards nominee for 2024. We are honored to be considered among such talented competition, but we need your vote. Head over to vote.webbyawards.com and vote for Masterpiece Studio in the podcast section, where you'll find us listed in the general television and film category. Voting closes Thursday, April 18th, so be sure to get your vote in soon. That's vote.webbyawards.com. Thank you.